Accession number 28750, Reel 10.
Laurie Manton, Reel 10. What are the implications of this for the professional, you know, people like yourself? If, you know, Joe Bloggs, these are so easy to use and he can do hundreds of photographs without too much thought and out of that get some really good images. Is it a threat to professionals, do you think, in the field?
I don't believe so. I mean, so it's a very good example of the power of the amateur photographer. Or even more than that, the bystander in the 7th of July bombings in London, where virtually every person in the vicinity seemed to have a camera phone and were then able to email their shots to the BBC and other media outlets. So they had the immediacy there of on-the-scene photographs, uncensored, which was sent off to be used, and again with the aftermath when they were when they cornered some of the terrorist suspects, there were people with their own cameras showing the what was going on as they encouraged the suspected terrorists to come out on the balcony and surrender. So this was amateur shot footage. You know, that there is obviously going to be some good material comes out of which would be used. And I'm sure most bystanders would have little pound signs going in their minds now, that they're a bit more savvy and think, well, you know, if the Daily Mail wants to put on the front page of their paper and I have a world exclusive, then they can pay me £5,000 for the privilege. Whereas in the past the trade unions were had things wrapped up so much that, you know, the photographers took the photos and it was the photographers' photos that were used, and occasionally a fantastic photograph by a member of the public would be used, but certainly writers couldn't take photographs in the same way that the photographers couldn't do the words, but it's sort of merging. There's a lot more photojournalists now. But, you know, for things that happen in this country, then you could say there's a bit of a threat for freelance photographers, because there's so many of them around doorstepping celebrities' homes, getting their £150 of data, stand there and maybe get a photograph. But your member of the public, Joe Soap, isn't going to have the funds to go off to a war and be an embedded photographer, or go to Bosnia and go around, suffer terrible privation and personal danger. So there's still the market for those that are brave enough and professional enough to get the pictures that are required.
Well, thank you very much for that, Laurie. That's really interesting and very central, I think, to the work you do, isn't it, this issue of technology? And now I suppose we're from the Gulf. Am I right in thinking you went on to Bosnia? Was it straight on?
Well, having done the Gulf and then, as we previously discussed, with the Kurds in northern Iraq, in 91 I started covering the Northern Ireland stories, and in 92...
Oh, it was 91, was it? Oh,
and
it was
Bosnia
early,
right. Started in 92.
Oh, right. And then you went back to Northern Ireland in 95, is that right?
Yes, I did.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
But so I covered it regularly between 91 and 95.
Yes. Right. So I wonder, would you rather do Northern Ireland all in one, or shall we go on to Bosnia?
I think do Bosnia first.
Right, and then we'll... But I mustn't forget that Northern Ireland is 91 as well as the later. So, Bosnia.
Bosnia. So, having watched on the television, suddenly all these armoured vehicles in Bosnia and Croatia and air attacks on these vehicles and talk of some sort of civil war, we found it... quite interesting, sitting within the offices of Soldier magazine. And then all of a sudden, a UN force, the United Nations force, was going to be sent in there. And people make the mistake thinking they were there as a peacekeeping force. Quite honestly, they were a force there that seemed to have little effect at all on what was going on. By their being in the locality, often they changed the course of an event, because perhaps an atrocity might not take place that day, because the you know, for example, the British soldiers were around. But I think, you know, Bosnia was a bit of a debacle that they let all this misery and killing and ethnic cleansing go on for so long. So we had a chance to get a team in to Croatia, which itself had been attacked by the Serbs, and quite considerable damage had been done. So I went over with soldier photographer Terry Champion. We flew into Split, and then we found a nice room in the Intercontinental Hotel, like all the journalists and photographers at that time. Very nice room, satellite television. Interesting, because all the UN people in Split were using the restaurant there to have a weekly themed dinner. So they might have an India, as in India, Indian food evening, because all the UN civilian workers were getting huge allowances and pots of money they didn't know what to spend their money on, which, you know, I found particularly difficult to deal with, because, okay, a lot of them face danger and were very brave, but there were a lot of people in administration and support who were living a high life, and it was almost like they used to say working in the EEC headquarters was a bit of a gravy train. Well, the allowances that you could make a lot of money from spending a year out there. But it was interesting, because we had a chance to very quickly to go to the Republic of Knin, K-N-I-N. And this was just over the Croatian border into Bosnia, but it was a, if you like, a Serb-held enclave. And they declared themselves the Serbian Republic of Knin, and had produced their own currency. So we got in there, because there were British troops in there. A very long and interesting journey in the back of a Land Rover, made memorable by crossing the border for the first time. And everyone stops to have a look at a scarecrow, and there's a scarecrow wearing a combat uniform and a blue United Nations helmet, with a little wooden board next to it, or hanging on the front of this dummy, which says, "Make love, not war." And you think, oh, it'd be nice to get a photograph taken with that. And then you look and you think, hang on, there's a dead bird of prey hanging from the hand of this dummy, which is not very nice. And you look closer, and there were mines all around this. So if anyone had actually gone up to this, they would have set off a mine which would have killed them. But photographically, it was very spectacular. And that was the first shot I took with my camera entering that theatre of conflict. So we got to the Republic of Knin, which was very weird, because the British were based next to an old Serbian or Yugoslavian army barracks. And of course it had been, you know, an Iron Curtain country, ruled by Tito. And once Tito had gone, there was no one with his charisma and power to keep the country together. Hence all the factions that had previously for hundreds of years fought each other had been peaceful until he died, and then it all went wrong. But the British troops were sort of, I won't say besieged, but within an old bit of barracks, surrounded by problems going on here, there and everywhere. So it was a bit of a risk for them to come into the Republic of Kunin, and a bit of a risk going out, and then there wasn't much to do in the meantime. And interestingly, and quite unusually, they didn't have any element of NAFI support to sell them soft drinks and crisps and such like, but they had those materials that they bought. And to pay for them, you bought from the quartermaster a chit with a certain number of units marked on it, you know, 1 to 50, which was equivalent to a certain amount of money, and you go along, and it was like the Second World War with the coupons. I'd like a can of Coke and two packets of crisps, and they cross off the relevant squares, and that's having bought this cheap scrap of paper, you were away. So that was quite interesting to see that, but nothing much was going on. But there was a certain amount of mine education going on. And when we were driving back, there was a hairpin bend on the side of a mountain, and our press officer driver from the Ministry of Defence sort of stopped, thought he'd seen something, and went to reverse up, and I said, "Stop, stop, stop." And he came around and he said, "What's the matter?" I said, "Is that not a mine on the road?" And if he'd reversed, he would have gone on to it. And it looked like a small tin of baked beans, that was the size of it. But it would have been enough to blow the wheel off the back of the truck off, which would have plunged over the edge, no doubt. So that made me realise that it was, you know, not a good situation to be in. So we eventually arrived back at Split, you know, reasonably happy. Back in the Intercontinental Hotel, this is wonderful, what's on satellite television, watch a film, go and have a nice meal in the hotel and watch the UN people having their wonderful themed meals again, as if nothing had happened. Well, at that time, the British forces had gone into Sarajevo, and they'd taken an old building, which was then the, like a skyscraper, that was the headquarters of the UN in the in Sarajevo. But the only way in was by RAF Hercules. And we were quite lucky because we managed to get a flight with a Special Forces Hercules, along with the head of the Royal Air Force at that time. It was on a reconnaissance mission to see what his people were putting up with. So we took off from Split in this Hercules, and then we were warned that in coming into land at Sarajevo Airport, which was really an embattled place, we would be doing a Kaisan landing, which the Americans had come up with in Vietnam. And literally, you're going along, and the aircraft is just put nose down, and you go hurtling for the ground, and they pull up at the last minute, and you slam onto the runway. But it momentarily makes you weightless, so you rise up at your seat as if you're an astronaut. Such is the impact of this drop, and they just say to people, you know, stand by, stand by, go, woof, and you all rise out of your seats. But we'll come back to that later in the story, as what happens when you're not on a seat and just stood in the back of a aircraft is a big difference. So we got down and we landed on the runway, and all you could see around the edge of the airport was pointing their barrels at us was a whole load of Serbian anti-aircraft guns. Got to the main terminal, we're told we could take a walk along past some wrecked hangars. And if we looked out from there, we could, from some of the defensive positions, and it was literally like First World War trenches, So there'd be little holes, and you'd look through, and you could see all the ruined houses the other side, which were all the Serbian troops were and their snipers. And they said, whatever you do, when you go between the buildings, where there's an open view from the Serb positions between the buildings, don't run, because that will encourage the snipers to fire, because they think you're frightened. I was deeply unimpressed when I'm halfway across and my photographer decides to trot off. But I kept walking slowly. And that was interesting to see all these wrecked houses. That was a bit worrying. It became even more worrying when I realised that the only way to get to the UN headquarters was to a journey in a military vehicle along what was known as Sniper Mile, where the vehicles would be shot at by the Serbs as they travelled at high speed down this dual carriageway. It's made worse by the fact we were in a French armoured vehicle. The people of that were, the crew were these French Foreign Legion guys, were a bit nervy because only the day before the Serbs had put a rocket propelled grenade straight in the back of a similar vehicle, which blew an eye and a cheek off one of the soldiers and seriously injured some of the others. And that's when the tension started to rise, bearing in mind we're civil servants, ostensibly, although employed as journalists and photographers. And it was very hot in there, and it was like being driven at breakneck speed in a empty tin can that was in boiling water. It was terrifying. Arrived at the UN headquarters, they parked up the vehicle and you literally jumped out and ran down into a huge underground car park, which was where a lot of the squaddies were living down there in camp beds. But you know, you had the full sound effects of the war that was going on all around the UN headquarters. So we then got up into the UN headquarters, which was interesting to see the basic conditions. And I think it had been the local telecommunications building, but it had suffered damage. It had been hit by shell fire and all the rest of it, so it was quite iffy. They had a lovely cafeteria, which was quite interesting. Within the cafeteria, we were given a chance to be taken out by a Royal Engineer Sergeant onto the what was originally the patio area in the dark to take photographs and film of the tracer bullets going across the sky in Sarajevo as the battles were continuing. This looked very interesting. And then some fool inside flicked the wrong light switch, which meant it floodlit the patio area. So we had to crawl back inside very quick. We decided we want some photographs from the other side of the building, so we came out of the car park along to a wall which was just above where the BBC had its editing suite, where Kate Ady was. We got some more photographs and said, not much going on, let's go back now. And as we got back under cover, there was a very loud explosion. A mortar had come in, big mortar, and exploded. And the next morning, we were shown that it exploded literally moments after we'd left that spot, and literally on that spot.
So they knew exactly, you know, what was happening and where people were.
But, you know, you've got some nice photographs of the airport and things like this. And remember, this was a flying visit because it was still early days. Did interviews with various officers and soldiers and such like. And then at that same spot in the morning, we were going to be put back into an armoured vehicle and then driven back along Sniper Mile up to the airport and then flown out again. Well, first of all, before the vehicle arrived, we went round and saw Kate Ady, and Kate remembered me from a year previously in the Gulf War, and said, you know, I was hit by shrapnel the other day. And she'd been out in the BBC's armoured Land Rover, and fire had been directed against the door, and a sliver of shrapnel came in and hit her on the ankle on her boot and bruised it, but she got away with it. And there they were editing the programmes to be broadcast on the news that night. But it had no windows, they'd been blown out. And they'd managed to get some metal sheets which were balanced with breeze blocks. And they would have flown through a shell or a bomb had hit nearby. So very dangerous conditions. So we get in the armoured vehicle, then asked to get out again because it had broken down. And I said, get on that truck over there. So we went on an army four-tonner vehicle, which had a canvas top, which is no protection at all, climbed up in there and sat on one of the wooden seats. And all the squaddies that were going to escort us were laughing their heads off. Ha ha ha, ha. You know, you're going to die. Ha, ha ha ha, you mad fools, and all this sort of thing. And then we were distracted, and suddenly saw them all looking very long-faced and walking in our direction. So what's going on? They said, our vehicle's broken down as well, so we've got to come with you. And their faces were ashen. And it was a little bit surreal, and I keep coming across these surreal things, because the British Army wasn't... at that early stage, used to working with the United Nations and wearing the blue helmet covers or blue berets. The blue helmet covers were from the British Army's and Royal Marines Arctic warfare stocks, which were white to blend in with the snow. They dyed them blue, but when it rained there, the blue dye came straight out. It wasn't fast at all. So they ended up with white helmet covers and blue faces, so they look really strange. They're not unlike Smurfs in a way, those cartoon characters. But we'd gone a short way along the sniper mile, and the four ton truck broke down, and the sergeant leapt out the back and rushed across to some of the Bosnian sentries and said, you know, what the hell are we going to do? And they said, well, you better get it fixed, because in a minute the Serbs will start firing at you. And it was that stage I got some really nice portraits of frightened soldiers who were literally just sat there with their rifles on the floor, holding onto the barrel and looking ashen-faced. So I was quite pleased with what I got, which took my mind off the extreme danger. Having got it restarted, we managed to get to the Sarajevo airport, jumped back on the Hercules, and there was a problem. They couldn't get one of the engines going, and the only way they felt they could get it going so we could take off was to run it down the runway, the aircraft, at high speed, and try and bump start it. And they did this two or three times, which infuriated the Serb gunners, who kept having this almost out of control aircraft hurtling straight at them, stopping, turning around and going back. And they must have thought they were, you know, trying to wind them up. And eventually on the third run down the runway it started, and then we went back and we were able to take off. But there you go, you leave by the it's just like being in the fastest elevator in the world, or lift. It's incredible. You just go straight up, and this one just pushes you down in your seat. And as we were going out, the aircraft realised it was that Serbian missile batteries had locked onto it. And they'd never actually fired at a plane before, So they took all sorts of actions. They had that chaff on board which they could have fired to deflect the missiles, but didn't need it. But then 3 or 4 days later, I think it was an Italian Hercules with UN people, was blown out of the sky in the same area. So we then have our short journey, land at Split, get back to the Intercontinental Hotel, where normal life is going on. But myself and Terry Champion, we were absolutely hyper. We were beside ourselves with hyperactivity. And we rushed straight into this cafeteria outside the hotel, still in our combat body armour with our helmets on. Both ordered the biggest fruit sundae you've ever seen, and we're sitting there giggling like idiots eating all this fruit sundae because we were so wound up with the stress of it. But then quickly relaxed, and that night we went down, having watched a film on telly, we went down to watch the UN people. I always describe it as pissing off the poor locals, the Croatians, by seeing these overpaid people spending pots of money on food. No, it's a really bad image problem that they had there. We then did some stories around Split, where various British units, support units, were based, and came back to the UK. By the time we went back a few weeks later, the British forces had moved into Bosnia proper, right through one of the fighting areas at Gornji Vukov, and then into Vitez, where they'd established a base.
End of Reel 10, Laurie Manton.